Yesterday during the discussion period, there were some questions directed to the round table where I was in front. And one of them I already answered, which is, what is economic development? And I answered by saying it's an improvement in people's material standards of living. Then there's a question from a lady who was sitting back there, and I don't see her here at the moment. She asked, is economic development good economics? And my answer to that would be, good economics involves answering the core question of economics, which is how to allocate scarce resources among alternative uses. And that immediately raises the question about what is the objective towards which those scarce resources are being allocated. And that, in turn, leads to the following formulation. One goal of economic development, in fact, I would say the primary goal of economic development, is to enable people to attain higher material standards of living, in part through their labor market earnings. That is, how much do they earn for the work they do? Some people work as wage and salaried employees. The poorer the country, the larger is the percentage of people who are working in self-employment. And so, in turn, it leads to what I would define as two concurrent problems, two major problems in the world. The first is the global poverty problem. Now, leaving aside questions of what the right poverty line is and what the right purchasing power parity adjustments are and so on, the figures that have come out indicate that of roughly 7 billion people in the world, 3 billion of those people are absolutely poor, earning less than $2.50 per person per day, adjusted for purchasing power parity, adjusted for what money will buy. 3 billion people is an astounding number. It is more than the population of Europe. It is more than the population of the United States. It is more than the population of Europe and the United States taken together. It is more than the population of China and India taken together. Just a huge number of people who are absolutely poor. And to me, that is the single most important economic development problem. In fact, the single most important economic problem in the world. Now, turning to the labor market, that is, the labor market is the place where labor services are bought and sold. Some people sell their labor services to other people, and we call those people employees, and the people who buy their labor services employers. Other people sell their labor services to themselves, and they're self-employed. The world has a global employment problem, the magnitude of which is that there are 200 million people in the world who are unemployed by standard ILO definitions, people who did no work for pay last week. 200 million is a large number, but it's a small number compared to the 900 million people in the world who are defined by the ILO as being working poor. These are people who live in households where one of the members of the household is employed. And yet, the people in the household live on less than two PPP dollars per person per day. So as we think about what the problem is that we're trying to identify and work on in the labor market, the problem is not just a problem of unemployment. Problem is, far more importantly, a problem of an employment problem, a problem of people who are working, who are earning very little for the work they do. So fighting poverty through the labor market is a largely understudied area in development economics. We talk about macroeconomic policies, and we talk about trade policies, and we talk about many, many things, but typically dealing with poverty as it affects people as workers is something we don't pay as much attention to. Now, here's a basic fact. Most people in the world derive most, if not all, of their income from the work they do. Okay? I look at my own income, right? The income of the Fields family is based on the earnings of the Fields family members. The interest rates are 0.01% in the United States, so we don't have much in the way of interest and dividend income, in part because interest rates are low, and in part because we don't have much capital to invest. And poor people have no capital to invest, and so consequently are deriving their income from their work. So when I talk about labor markets and labor market policies in this discussion this morning, I'll be talking then about the labor market. It's the place where labor services are bought and sold. It includes wage employment and includes self-employment. It includes agriculture, includes non-agriculture. And there's some people who say that the labor market is only a part of that, and I have no idea why they say that, but they do. And I'm just going to say that that's not the way that labor economists think about it. Now, the question that I would then ask would be, as we talk about development policies of any kind, how would development policies affect people like these? These four people are on the cover of my latest book, which is entitled Working Hard, Working Poor. And in the book, one of the chapters is devoted to telling their stories. Now, in about 10 seconds each, I will tell you their stories. Kalavati, the woman on the upper left, lives in India. She hand rolls poor people cigarettes that are called bidis, and she earns a little more than a dollar per 11-hour day for the work she does. The woman on the upper right, Masibisi, lives in South Africa. She and her husband and her eldest son are engaged in a handicraft business, which they found to be quite lucrative. They manufacture Zulu shields, about 3 feet high. 3 feet is 1 meter. The Zulu people use them for ceremonial purposes, and tourists like me buy them. And if you come to my office at the university, you'll see my Zulu shield, which I bought from her family. Angela, the woman on the lower left, is a fireworks manufacturer in Mexico, a trade that she learned from her mother. And she's hoping to expand out of the fireworks business and into the celebrations business, which would include baking cakes and sewing dresses and growing flowers and generally earning a better livelihood in that way. Farmer Wang lives in China. Farmer Wang has earned his way out of poverty through three mechanisms. The first is that he lives in China. The second is that the Wang family was allocated a large amount of land when the communist government turned land over to individual households for cultivation. At the time, there were lots of Wangs, and so they got lots of plots, and so they continued to do well. The third thing with Farmer Wang is that his daughter, he has more than one daughter, which itself is a story, but anyhow, one of his daughters married an American who has an MBA and works for a finance company in New York City. And so this family remits a lot of money. And so the Wangs are in good shape. These are the kinds of people that I think we want to have in mind. I put their pictures up on the wall in my office so that I don't forget that the development policies are about real people. And we're not posing the question how to help any one of these people, although that's an interesting question in its own right, but it's how do we help the 3 billion people like these? And when we think about what work are they doing and how could they earn better livelihoods? So here's now where the economist in me comes in. Sound labor market policies require sound labor market models. We often talk about policies forgetting that there is an analytical framework that might underlie some of these policy discussions. And the analytical framework would be to model labor markets in a way relevant to the experiences, the situation, the circumstances of the country in question. So what characterizes sound labor market models? I've listed three characteristics. The first is that from a welfare economic point of view, We want to make explicit policy judgments, ones that are mutually consistent and that are thoroughly worked out, in the sense that the judgments we make are based on, to use our economist language, they're based on maximans or minimans. There's something you're trying to achieve, which is to maybe to maximize GDP or its growth, though I don't think that's the right one, or maybe it's to minimize poverty, which I think is much closer to being the right one. In fact, it's a very good one to use. Secondly, sound labor market models, from a theoretical point of view, should be sufficiently detailed and suitably rigorous. Sufficiently detailed means that it has enough sectors. I don't believe for a minute that you can model a country's labor market as though every working person in that country earns the same amount as everybody else, and all of them are fully and gainfully employed. Okay. We have to have a finer labor market characterization than that. And then from an empirical point of view, the theoretical models guide and are guided by solid quantitative evidence. We look out in the world, people do empirical studies, we find out what the world looks like, and then we internalize that understanding, we stylize it, we don't take every single detail, we choose the relevant ones, and that's what goes into our model. So sound welfare economics, a theoretically well-formulated set of relationships, and sound empirical foundations. Now, let me talk about those a little bit. In Working Hard, Working Poor, which is the title of the book that I mentioned, there are a number of generalizations that I make that apply to developing countries as a whole. I'm not going to read through all of these. I just want to point out the last two because I think they're important for the discussion that we're about to have. The first is that if you look just at unemployment rates defined by ILO definitions, you're unemployed if you did not work even 1 hour for pay last week, or you worked fewer than 15 hours not for pay in a family business or a family farm, and you actively looked for work. Okay? People who aren't actively looking for work, they're just hoping that a job might appear someday, are not counted in the official statistics as being unemployed. Using that definition, unemployment rates are actually lower in the developing countries than they are in the richer countries. And this is what's commonly referred to as the luxury unemployment hypothesis, is that the children of people like ourselves, who, when they graduate from university, if they don't find the right job right away, can be supported by us. Okay? In the developing countries, you have about a week or 2 weeks before somebody says to you, okay, go out and earn some money. And so what do? You buy, you save up enough money to buy a package of 20 cigarettes, and then you sell them to people even poorer than you, one at a time, for a higher unit cost, and that enables you to earn enough money to buy the next package of cigarettes and buy a little bit of food, and life goes on like that. And then to repeat what I said before, what the developing countries have primarily, and I would say, by the way, the OECD countries do as well, is that they have an employment problem, that is, poverty among those who work, rather than an unemployment problem. So it's not just let's employ the unemployed and create more jobs, it's to create more and better earning opportunities for people who are already working. So here are the main problems that workers in the developing world face. An insufficient number of good jobs, okay? Buying a package of 20 cigarettes and then selling them one at a time is a job, but it's a really bad job. And there aren't enough good jobs. Uncertainty of work, not knowing whether there will be work for you when you show up at the workplace in the morning. You're a day laborer. There may be a construction work for you. There may be porter work for you, or there may not be. And that uncertainty is what people face often every day. Low earnings despite long hours. The woman whose picture I showed you before, Kalavati, takes her 11 hours a day to hand roll 1,000 of those beaties. And as I said, she earns a little bit more than $1 a day for the work she does, adjusted for what money will buy. And so it's she has low earnings, not because she's working short work days. She has low earnings because she earns so little per hour of labor. People in the developing world typically have few job-related social protections. You might call them citizenship benefits. You might call them social security. Whatever it is you call it, the poorer the country, the fewer such programs there are and the more limited they are to the very top people. Government civil servants get those protections. People who hand roll cigarettes or make fireworks do not. And then there's the problem of indecent work, work where we'd rather not have people doing those jobs at all. Child prostitution, slavery, indentured servitude, things that are violations of the human condition. But a lot of people are in those partly because they got forced into them, or in some cases they made the best of a dreadful alternative. If you know the book or you know the movie Sophie's Choice, they had to make the kind of choices that no person should be made to make. And they're engaged in indecent work. So how do we then go about dealing with these problems? Well, one is to try to formulate multi-sector labor market models. And the essence of those multi-sector labor market models would be, first of all, that there are multiple sectors. Secondly, that the framework is one of a dualistic or a segmented labor market. Dualistic would mean two. You know, if you go from one labor market to more than one labor market, a natural starting point is two, as opposed to economists' tendency to go from one to N. Right? I know how to think like that, but I don't find it particularly helpful in dealing with issues like this one. So the key features of these dualistic or segmented labor markets is that are, first of all, that there are better and worse jobs. Not all jobs are the same. It's not like some people are choosing, as in one well-known labor market model, the Roy model. So everybody can choose whether to hunt or whether to fish. The people that have skill in hunting choose hunting. The people that have skill in fishing choose fishing. The people like me who have skill in neither one choose whichever one would pay an unskilled person the most in that particular activity. But that's not the right model, I think. The right model is there's a job ladder, a job hierarchy, good jobs, bad jobs. Everybody would like the good jobs. Only some of the people can get hired into the good jobs. Those that don't have then a choice between working in the bad jobs as part of the economy or not working at all. And typically, since they have nothing to fall back on, they take the worst jobs. So there are better and worse jobs in a segmented labor market model, and the better jobs are rationed. Sometimes they're rationed according to who happens to get there at the time when they're hiring at precise moment. Sometimes not. Ankula, the fireworks manufacturer whose picture I showed you, had twin adult children, a daughter and a son. Her daughter explained to me that she had sneaked into the United States and cleaned hotel rooms in the United States for a couple of years. She knew how to clean hotel rooms. Her mother got sick. She returned to Mexico, and she tried to get a job cleaning hotel rooms in the city of Oaxaca. She couldn't get hired. The way the daughter explained it is, well, lots of people want to clean hotel rooms, and she explained, I am not beautiful. Okay, well, it's true, she was not beautiful, but why was that relevant? It's because to get a job cleaning hotel rooms in Oaxaca, you had to sleep with the right person. And the person who had the power in this situation didn't find her attractive, and so she didn't get the job. So the rationing may be on sound or not so sound foundations. So the ingredients of a multi-sector labor market analysis, then, is to specify how do the good job sectors of the economy work? How do the poor jobs sectors of the economy work? And how do they link to one another? One way in which they might link to one another is everybody tries to get a good job. Those that don't go to work in the bad job sector. Okay? That's the Arthur Lewis story. Another way in which they might link is that the good jobs sector, the good jobs are located in one physical part of the economy, like the cities. The bad jobs are located in the countryside. If you want to get a good job, you have to migrate to the city, or you risk being unemployed if you don't get hired. That's the Harris-Todaro story. And we have alternate labor market models to embody the multi-sector labor market approach. I'm not saying that any one of these models is right in all circumstances or wrong in all circumstances. What I would do if I were trying to do this kind of analysis for a developing country. So my next stop on this multi-continent trip I'm in the midst of is Peru. I've never been to Peru. But when I get off the plane, I'm going to have in mind a small number of candidate models for how the Peruvian labor market works. And I'm going to try to find out enough about how it works in that particular country in order to contribute to a workshop that will be held next week about trying to deal with Peruvian labor market problems and specifically how to formalize those who are working informally. So I'll try it as best I can to choose from among the available models. So how do we help the poor earn their way out of poverty? Here are five possible approaches. One is to provide basic workplace protections, to say, here are the rules that operate in the workplace. Second, to try to harness the energies of the private sector to create more and better jobs. Third, to have the right macro policies in place, economic growth, international trade, foreign assistance, some of the issues that Danny Roderick in particular talked about yesterday. Fourth, to try to have labor market policies for generating more paid employment. And fifth, to try to raise self-employment earnings. Because as I said before, the poorer the country, the larger the percentage of people who are working in self-employment as opposed to wage employment. The development of skills pervades all of these. And so thinking in terms of what are the binding constraints, is that lack of jobs or lack of skilled people to fill available jobs would be the kind of diagnostic question one might want to ask. So let me present some concluding thoughts. First about policy making and second about some research needs. On policy making, what I've suggested to you is that we want to have something that we're trying to maximize or something that we're trying to minimize. We want to have good theoretical understandings of how labor markets work. The various labor markets, and then how the various labor markets interact with each other. We want to have a good empirical understanding to help guide our theoretical modeling. So what are some of the pitfalls in doing policy making? Sometimes people make inappropriate use of productivity-based concepts. The way I can tell whether a person's training is in development economics or labor economics is very simple. Development economists think that wages are determined by productivity. Labor economists think that wages are determined by supply and demand or by labor market institutions like labor unions, minimum wages, and other things. Okay? And so we have to be careful about how we combine those different ideas. Second pitfall in policymaking is to rely on the wrong kinds of empirical studies. The question is not how do we help any single person earn more money, because we can help any given person earn more money by providing that person with more education and more skills. But that's not the right question. The right question is how do we get more people in the economy as a whole to be earning more money? If you get trained, if you get a degree at the Sorbonne, and somebody else does not, and your degree enables you to get hired for a certain job, and somebody else doesn't get hired for that job because you do, we still have the same total employment. It's just is reallocated among different individuals. And so the right kind of empirical study is one that asks how does the market respond to various policy interventions that we might be thinking about. This in turn relates to a fallacy of composition. A fallacy of composition is because it's good for somebody, it's good for everybody, as opposed to because it's good for somebody, that job getting might come, or that self-employment opportunity might come at somebody else's expense. We need to look at that. Bad policymaking, a pitfall, is to think about only some of the goods and bads. For example, minimum wage policy. Some people favor minimum wages because they want workers to earn more. Other people oppose minimum wages because they think that minimum wages will result in less employment. Each of those looks at only one of the consequences and not the other. It's a predictable consequence that a higher minimum wage will lead to higher wages for those who remain employed. It's also a predictable consequence that a higher minimum wage or a high enough minimum wage will cause fewer people to be employed. And we want to consider both of those in our analysis. Francois, you talked yesterday about social cost benefit analysis and how it disappeared, and I'd already put this on the slide. We need to think in terms of social cost benefit analysis. If we use our money, our limited resources in a particular way, what benefits do we get? And why do we think that the benefits from using the money that way outweigh the benefits from using the money in some other way? We need to ask those sorts of questions. So, four priorities for labor market research that I would identify. First is to understand as best we can why the people in developing countries are doing what they are doing. A lot of models assume that people are engaged in essentially unconstrained occupational choices. I don't think that's right. People can choose to try to clean hotel rooms and be hired in such work. But that doesn't mean that they can choose to be hotel room cleaners. Some people get chosen. And who does the choosing? Employers do the choosing. And they choose how many to hire, and they choose which people to hire. And so those that don't get hired do something else. Why are they doing that? In most cases, I would say it's because they tried to get wage and salaried employment and could not. A smaller number of people had wage and salaried employment. They worked in the Ford Motor garage, learned how to be auto mechanics, got the human capital, saved up the financial capital in order to buy their own tools, and then set up their own backyard auto mechanic shop. Those people have chosen to be self-employed auto mechanics. I think most people who are self-employed don't choose to be self-employed. It's that they can't get hired for anything better. Secondly, a priority for labor market research is to have empirically grounded theoretical models of labor markets. As part of my own research agenda, I've been working with various co-authors to develop a generic model with two self-employment sectors, one that is above wage and salaried employment, one that is below. Rather than assuming either one or the other. I've been working with another co-author on a labor market model for China and with another co-author on a labor market model for India. And they have different features from each other, as indeed they need to. China has a hukou system. India doesn't. India has primarily agriculture and seasonality. China does not. And so these are the kinds of issues to be in those models. Two last points. Sector level and market level analysis is what we need, as opposed to individual level analysis. I think we can learn a lot from individual level analysis, but in the end, we need to understand how these individual choices and the constraints on individual choices affect the opportunities that people have in the market as a whole. Finally, we need empirical analysis on which particular policy interventions will matter how much in terms of social benefits and social costs. If I could talk to policymakers and ask them one single question, the question I would ask would be, why do you think that this particular intervention that you're talking about would have a larger impact on poverty reduction than some other intervention? And just to give you an example, I would not spend €1 on improving labor market information systems for people in developing countries. That just simply reallocates the existing jobs among individuals. It doesn't create more jobs. I know that I would use the money to try to create more and better wage employment opportunities or to add to people's self-employment earning opportunities, for example, through microcredit programs. I don't know what the right answer is. I have a pretty good idea about what the wrong answer is because of thinking in terms of social benefits and social costs. So let's just be humble enough to know that there are times when we know more or less what's going on, and at the same time, to be humble enough to know that we do not know. And speaking as academics and as researchers, we have to say the right answer is that I don't know. Okay. Now, if we're policymakers and we have to decide, we have to offer advice, you're a World Bank mission, you go out to the country, by the end of the time you leave, you have to submit a report, you have to come up with the best answer you can. Okay. But let's try. And with that, I'll stop. Thank you very much.